For decades, fluffy, well-groomed lawns have been the trademark of American life. Americans spend about $40 billion a year on lawn care, and a tiny lawn has even come to suggest good character. But all that is starting slowly to change. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As more and more people raise concerns about the chemicals needed to keep perfect green lawns and the water needed to irrigate them, the anti-lawn movement is on the rise, including one variation, the edible estate. Today, the argument against the lawn, why letting go of your lawn might be better for you, your neighbors, and the planet. Our guests this hour are Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker, and Fritz Haig, an artist, architect, and creator of the Edible Estates Project. I want to thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Colbert, let's start with you. You wrote a piece in The New Yorker about this, the history, the legacy of Americans' love affair with the lawn. Can you tell us where this idea of green mowing perfection came from?
Well, the idea of the lawn, you know, goes pretty far back to the British and to manor houses and got imported into this country not until 19th century, and didn't really catch on until the lawnmower was developed and suburbs started to spring up in the latter half of the 19th century. And then lawns really took off as we laid out suburbs with these large setbacks and these plot of land, you know, with nothing to do on it. But before that time, really, you know, people couldn't afford the luxury of spending a lot of time taking care of land that wasn't producing any food. So people, you know, either had dirt or they had gardens, productive spaces, pastures.
And it used to be just something that the very wealthy could afford to do, right? So it at one point got a lot more affordable for the average American.
Right. I mean, if you try to think about mowing a lawn without a lawnmower, you're either out there with a scythe, which is pretty time-consuming, or in English manor houses, they sometimes used, you know, sheep, but, you know, you need someone to take care of your sheep, and you need to have enough space to have sheep. So they were really a tremendous luxury, and even when they moved to this country in the 19th century, the first people to have lawns were the very wealthy, the Livingston Estate, places like that where crews of, you know, a dozen people took care of the grounds.
Well, one thing I hadn't really realized is that lawns are pretty unnatural, at least from a horticultural perspective, right?
Well, you know, sort of by definition, they're unnatural because they have to be cut. If it's not cut, it's not a lawn. You know, it's a meadow. It just doesn't exist. And then when you get into trying to get it to be grasses, turf grasses, a monoculture, most turf grass is not native to this country. That's really key to understand. It was brought over from other parts of the world. So it demands a lot of upkeep. And then if you try to keep out other plants, which naturally, you know, just seed themselves, clover, plantains, all the things that you find in lawns, then we turn to things like herbicides, which have a pretty significant environmental impact. So lawns are unnatural, and have become increasingly unnatural as we figured out more and more chemical ways to get rid of what we don't want. And unfortunately, getting rid of what we don't want, one of the lessons has always been when you get rid of what you don't want, you often get rid of a lot of things that you do want, too, as sort of collateral damage.
It was interesting to me to note that in Toronto, it seems as though they have banned lots of the chemicals and fertilizers used on lawns as a public health enemy.
Yes, you can still use synthetic fertilizer, but you cannot use virtually any lawn chemical, and there are a lot of very common ones that we use in this country. Something called 7 is very widely used on lawns. The herbicide 2,4-D, very widely used. Those have all been banned, and they all have health studies associated with them that suggest risks to humans, and also, perhaps even more significantly to some people, at least, is they have pretty serious effects on wildlife. So they have banned, you know, virtually all lawn chemicals, and there's a real movement in Canada that's spreading to all of Ontario and other parts of the country. So I suspect it will get to this country at some point.
Fritz Haig, let's bring you in on this. You're the creator of the Edible Estates Project. Looking through your book, you've got pictures of what, you know, would have just looked like typical American lawns. And I have to say, after reading some of the essays in your book, like one by Michael Pollan, they really start to look sort of haunting and vacuous. Is that how you see the lawn?
Well, I'm very interested in the iconic nature of the front lawn in America. I'm interested in it as a space that we all collectively tend, and a space that cuts across all geographic, political, even economic boundaries in our country, and it's something that we all, I think a lot of Americans strive for, the perfect lawn, and it represents some sort of American ideal. And yeah, once you begin to look at these and you see this survey of images of front lawns accompanied by these stories of the reality of it, it becomes, you know, there's something slightly insidious about it when you realize the space that on the surface we come to believe is representing some form of beauty, actually is quite like, you know, ugly and disturbing when you look at the story beneath it, which I guess Elizabeth is starting to hint at least the ecological impact. But I'm also interested in the social impact of a space like that, that really is a powerful isolator and divider just spatially in our cities and our neighborhoods.
Well, tell us a little bit about the anti-lawn movement. What is it? What are the big arguments against the lawn?
Well, I mean, obviously there's all of the environmental impacts we were just hearing about. There's also, of course, what happens when you're mowing it with the two-stroke motor. I'm just kind of amazed by the space that that can be chemically toxic, that can waste precious water, which is especially true here in Southern California, that's polluting when it's mowed. And then not only is it not used often, the front lawn is what I'm talking about here, but it's also actively isolating people. So on every level, it seems to be a completely unproductive, if not actively kind of destructive sort of space. And I think there's a lot of alternatives to that space. In the Edible Estates project that I've been doing, I'm focused exclusively on the front lawn and that space between the front door and the street. That seems particularly unnecessary as a lawn. There's 30 million acres of lawn, I believe, in America, and I don't know what percent is front lawn, domestic front lawn space, or you know, spaces like that surround homes or apartment complexes. But I think that's probably target number one, I would say, in the anti-lawn movement, because there's plenty of other uses of lawns in our society that I think are defensible. And you know, obviously, there's a real pleasure associated with the lawn and little kids and pets running around on lawns and using it as a recreation space obviously has its benefits. But there's a huge percentage of lawns that we have in our cities today that are just are only there really out of lack of imagination. And because the industry that's set up to support them makes it, at least for the moment, cheaper than other alternatives. And I think that's obviously not going to last much longer.
Well, I've got to say, all of this made me feel a lot better about the current state of my lawn, which hasn't been mowed in, I don't even want to think about how long it's been. But now I'm thinking, as long as it's gotten this far, maybe we should just go in a different direction with it. What are some of the alternatives that you could do with a lawn that's starting to go to seed, turn into a meadow? What are some of the things that we could do?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the specific project I've been working on, obviously, is turning that unproductive space into a productive space that's an edible landscape that's producing food. So in calling it the edible estate, I'm trying to give it some legitimacy in our society that apparently needs, you know, we have branding and like massive branding and marketing campaigns for a new kind of mouthwash, and yet we don't seem to have any real branding and marketing, budgets to go towards these sorts of more important, developments in our society. So in a few of the projects I'm doing, I'm thinking about how we can reposition and reconsider these spaces in our cities. And it's really, I think it gets down to real aesthetic issues of what we as Americans believe is beautiful in the landscape. And we've inherited this sort of ridiculous ways of occupying the land, and it's currently what we think of as beautiful. So I think it's a lot of it has to do with expanding those ideas. So specifically with with the Edible Estates project, I'm just very, very narrowly focused on creating 9 of these gardens in the United States, dividing the country into 9 squares and doing a regional prototype garden, as I call them, in each area, so that it kind of represents what's possible there. Because, you know, if you're going to give instructions about how to grow a lawn, it's pretty much the same anywhere in the planet. But when you're growing food, it's highly regional, as are most alternatives to the lawn. Once you stop growing a lawn and you start doing something else, be it natives or a xeriscape, low water landscape, or something like that, or a meadow, suddenly you have to pay attention to where you are and what your climate is and what grows in your region and what will do well without the sort of kind of life support system of chemicals and irrigation and things like that.
Well, I want to get back and talk more about what exactly the edible estates are. But Elizabeth Colbert, can you give us a sense, too, about some of the other things anti-lawn people are advocating to do instead of doing the mown turf?
Well, I mean, one of the major problems with lawns from a societal point of view is that they consume a tremendous amount of water. We're growing lawns in places that, turf grass would simply not naturally grow. In the Southwest, even in the Southeast, where it can get very hot and dry in the summer, and lawns just tend to sort of shrivel up without a lot of water. So one thing that people have advocated for a while, and in fact in some places there are even increasingly sort of local ordinances making sure that you're not penalized for this, because there's a lot of lawn laws still on the books that really sort of force people to have lawns. Is this dry land landscaping. And that does, as Fritz was suggesting, it takes an initial investment of time, really, probably more than money, of putting in plants that are appropriate to a dry landscape, and they take a while to fill in, so the first few years can be a little sparse. So it's a big project, but over the long run, it saves tremendous amounts of water, and probably actually over the long run saves time and money too. So that's one thing that people advocate. Now, just generally, you can put native plants, and you can, and that's very region specific. There's a group called Wild Ones, which advocates, which is really sort of the first and maybe still largest sort of anti-lawn group, which advocates putting in native plants that are native to your area in what used to be the lawn. So that, I can't give you a blanket statement about what that is. You can go to their website. They have chapters all over, and they give advice about what is native, in fact, to your part of the world, or if it's not actually native, what would tend to thrive there with relatively little care. So those are some of the ideas that are out there. And then, there's everything from, moss. Some people advocate moss. So there's all sorts of ideas out there once you start thinking about it. Plant, dig it up, plant trees, plant shrubbery. But it depends on, what kind of a space you're trying to create.
Well, Fritz Haig, you're the creator of the Edible Estates Project, as we've been talking about a bit. And your idea is that we take these front lawns, which are just these blank spaces of turf grass, and turn them into really producing land. And there are pictures in your book of some of these edible estates, and they're really lovely. My sense is that you really incorporate art into them as well. There's an English garden that's sort of in the space of a kind of a modified spiral. They're really lovely. And is the idea here that the neighbors, that the whole community comes together around this garden?
Well, I'm trying to make gardens that are in a lot of different situations, in all the different kind of conditions where people are hidden behind a lawn where they live, be that an apartment complex or a suburban home. In the case of the London garden that you mentioned, that was commissioned by Tate Modern, the art museum in London, and we found this is the least green part of London, by the way, so this gets also just into issues of urban agriculture and things like that. But a triangular lawn that was unoccupied, surrounded by council housing estates. And in that case, yes, that's a garden that is being communally tended and eaten from by the residents of those buildings. So in that case, I think it's a model of how we can look at turning over these unused pieces of lawns in cities into places that people are eating from. But also, as you mentioned, the reason I'm looking at the front lawn is because it's so public. This is a unique opportunity in our cities, as I see it, of a vast amount of unproductive, essentially unused land, which as we spread out further and further, I think it's important for us to really pay attention to what we already have occupied and look at how effectively we're using it. And in the case of these front lawns or these very public unused green spaces in cities, it's important that they be visible. I think a garden, I'm interested in making productive edible gardens highly visible in our cities. And I think if you look at everything that a lawn doesn't do, an edible garden is extremely diverse as opposed to a monoculture. I mean, a really healthy garden, a really healthy edible garden can be very diverse, which, of course, the lawn isn't as a monoculture. In a lawn, you basically have to eliminate, eradicate every organism, every other plant life, you know, any sort of animal life. And I think these gardens are supposed to be, I want them to be really beautiful. You know, the design, they're meant to be very, very beautiful to show what's possible in an edible landscape. But also in the series of gardens that I'm doing, I'm also trying to make them not too fancy or not too nice, because I want anyone to look at them and feel like they could do it themselves. And maybe there's people can even do them better. Like, I think this should be something that anyone could interpret any possible way. Whereas, of course, you know, that's not the case with a lawn, where we like uniformity.
It sounds fantastic, and the pictures are gorgeous, but I listen to you and I think that sounds like so much work that I don't have to put in right now. I mean, now I can mow the lawn or not mow the lawn, depending on it, but planting a garden and tending it, that's a time commitment.
Yeah, I'm interested in exactly those kind of issues that come up in my project, because I'm really interested in what this says about us today and how we're living. Do we have time for this today? Will we have time in a decade when food becomes so expensive we can't afford not to do it? You know, you look at moments in history like the Victory Garden, Victory Gardens, or Dig for Victory in Britain. You know, the farmers were away, and the federal government encouraged everyone to do their part by growing some food on their property, and people did it. And, you know, up to 80% of Americans were doing that. And as soon as the war ended, that dried up right away. So we do it when we have to, when it's necessary. I think it is a lot of work. And, you know, the project that I'm doing, there's nothing new about it. It's like the most primitive possible thing, like growing your own food. And I think it's something that, the project is partly ridiculous, because it's true. Like, most Americans aren't going to do this. And for most Americans, it is a ridiculous thought to grow their own food in their front lawn. But it's also very serious, and it's very... you know, the thoughtful questions that come up. I think it's interesting to live in a society where it's cheaper to buy a T-shirt, much cheaper to buy a T-shirt than you could ever, than, you know, buying the fabric and making one. It's much cheaper to buy your food than to grow it. And yet we're coming up on all sorts of issues about, well, where is this food grown and under what conditions? And when it shifts from the other side of the planet, how much longer are we going to be able to afford to do that? So, If not someone growing all of their food in their front yard, I think we're going to look at it. We're going to be seeing more and more people growing at least some of their food in their own property. And with the edible estates gardens, there's an infinite possible ways of doing it. It could mean removing your lawn and planting a mini orchard of fruit trees that over time require very little care or maintenance, or an herb garden or perennials that once established, and if they're, you know, somewhat appropriate regionally and, you know, irrigated properly, you know, require in some cases less care than a lawn, you know, in many cases. A very high maintenance edible garden would be full of annuals, vegetables and herbs that are switched out every season. And obviously that would require a fair amount of time and, you know, in some cases more than a lawn, but, you know, but at least that time and money and resources and water that was dumped into something, you know, wasn't polluting, and it was producing food.
We're going to take a quick break right now, and Fritz Haig, you'll be with us for the rest of the hour, but Elizabeth Colbert, I want to thank you for joining us this hour and talking about your article, Turf War.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for being with us. Elizabeth Colbert is a writer for The New Yorker and the author of Turf War, about how Americans can't live without their lawns, but how long can they live with them. That ran in the July 21st issue. We're talking about the anti-lawn movement this hour and wondering how much stock you put in a green, well-cut yard. Do you care if your neighbors are letting their lawns go? And would you consider a front yard edible garden instead? We'd love to hear your take on the lawn at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lots of great stuff still to come on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. After 2, two psychiatrist authors talk about depression and treatments. Veronica Rickert, back with you as we talk lawns here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about specifically the anti-lawn movement and the move away from that green mown crew cut of lawn that requires lots of water and sometimes lots of chemicals, and looking at some alternatives to that, maybe letting it go back to its native state, maybe putting an edible garden in like Fritz Haig has done. He's an artist, architect, and creator of the Edible Estates Project. And we're also going to be joined this half hour by Ted Steinberg. Dave, he is the Davey Professor of History in the History Department of Case Western Reserve University. Ted Steinberg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I should point out, you're also the author of American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. And I want to go to the phones now and take a phone call from Rick in Milwaukee. Hi, Rick, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to respond to the question you raised 15 minutes or so ago about what to do with your, quote, lawn, or as I prefer, landscape. And my suggestion is to do nothing with it, to simply let nature take its course, to see what random developments take place on and in that soil. And you'll see fascinating things happen if you want to be fascinated by it, or you might just simply ignore it and get on with one's life doing other things, and allow the carbon dioxide to be absorbed and all the other good things that can happen with not disturbing that land that surrounds one's home.
What have you done with your lawn or landscape, Rick?
In the present place we live, we've lived here 28 years, we've done essentially nothing with it. And beautiful things come in like dandelions, which we eat, and chicory, and wild grapevine came in, and that can be steamed and eaten if one's interested in that. Otherwise, one can just view where these things grow. Some years they do very well. Say the grapevine, and other years they don't do as well. Like the grapevine is flourishing this year. Sometimes my wife has been interested in doing little things, like she tried putting in some ground cover, and that's been fighting against the various plants that have come in randomly. But we've done nothing to foster that ground cover. And at one point, she became interested in growing a crabapple tree. So we're now growing a crabapple tree in the backyard. And that interacts with the various other things that have grown up randomly in the backyard.
Do you have neighbors? And if so, do they object?
Not to our knowledge. They may say something to each other about it, but there's been no complaints we're aware of. The city has come in, I think, three times in 28 years and put up notices, and we then fight that by saying that we prefer to do nothing, and perhaps they'd like to see us in court.
That's pretty extreme there. That's maybe what some people have to go up against. And Ted Steinberg, what do you think when you hear a story like Rick's about what he's done with his lawn? How do you think that fits in with the idea of a well-tended lawn in a neighborhood?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with it at all, myself. But I think I don't know what the notices were about that the city put up, but it's not at all uncommon in the United States for there to be weed ordinances and grass height ordinances on the books, which prevent people from and limit the kinds of opportunities people have to experiment, like your listeners doing there with lawns.
What do you think about in general? Has the culture changed in terms of what neighbors are willing to tolerate, what neighborhoods are willing to tolerate in terms of how far people would like to take their lawn or their landscape in front of their house?
You mean recently?
Yeah.
It seems, I think there probably is a bit more of a, at least in my neighborhood here in Shaker Heights, which is a landscape, very immaculately landscaped community. I think there's a lot more tolerance for diversity in landscapes. That's what I've been noticing more recently. Which isn't to say that people are doing precisely the same thing that your listener is doing, which is to say let the lawn just or the yard just do whatever whatever comes naturally. But I do see a lot of people, at least with lawns similar to my own lawn, which is what I would describe as a kind of a just basically a very low maintenance affair. Not all really that far from what your listener there has got going.
Thank you for that call, Rick. And let's go now to Roger in Iowa City. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm in Iowa County. I do edible landscaping. I have edible lawn or edible landscaping in my yard, and I just wanted to say a couple things. I say that lawn is one of the three religions of the United States. And you're talking about it like being more work to plant vegetables. It's really not. Because if you look at mowing the lawn, watering it if people do, any weeding of the lawn, and then raking your leaves in the fall, and all of that put together, we don't think of that as work because it's just what we're supposed to do. But if you looked at all of that amount of work, and people will hire a lawn care service or buy a mower, which gives them zero back other than having a lawn, it's not more work, it's more thought to start with. And if people would hire an edible landscape helper or gardener to get them started, edible landscaping, taken to the full extent, is actually a designed and planted landscape, which is a mix of ornamentals and edibles, and at first glance, people would just admire what a nice landscape it is, not even realize it's edible.
Some interesting points there, Roger, and you bring to mind a recent article in the New York Times about how some very wealthy people in, I think it is New York, obviously, are doing just that, that the companies are thriving now where people come in and plant a little garden for you, take care of it for you, harvest the vegetables, and leave them on your back porch. Did you read that that article, Fritz Haig?
Yeah, that was just yesterday, the day before, I think. I saw part of it. I think it was in the Bay Area, maybe.
Maybe the Bay Area, okay.
Yeah. Well, I think that's fascinating as a development, isn't it? I think in what I wrote in the Edible Estates book at the end of the essay, I kind of speculate on, well, what will people do when they don't have, let's say they don't have time to do this and they're used to hiring someone to do everything on their property? Like, well, maybe you do have a situation where you have migrant farm workers come through the suburban neighborhoods farming front lawns and turning entire streets over into particular crops or something. But I think I'm just fascinated by these developments, what happens, how shifts happen in our culture economically and culturally that transform the way we live and transform the way we think about our cities and what's appropriate in the landscape.
Do you agree with Roger that once it's sort of laid down and you put the thought into it, that an edible landscape doesn't have to be more work than a lawn?
It doesn't have to be, no, exactly. I think, these things, lawns are very easy to generalize about. We can talk about lawns in a broad, general way in American society without much problems. When you start talking about growing food, it's impossible to generalize. It's so diverse. Like, depending on where you are, what kind of climate you're in, what you're planting, it totally depends. I mean, a lawn in England requires much less care than a lawn in Southern California. And I grew up in Minneapolis. That's where I'm from. So I spent a lot of time on our lawn and in our vegetable garden, and I know in Minnesota and Wisconsin we have a much shorter growing season than we do in Southern California. So just the kind of things you grow, you know, what's in perennial here is an annual there in some cases. So, you know, it just depends. But in response to that, it doesn't have to be. I mean, you can go about planning an edible landscape that's very smart in your local climate, and It just takes a lot more thought. You have to research and think about things. It's not like going to the store and buying seeds, pesticides, and dumping water on. And it's kind of, that's kind of a vapid, mindless activity that doesn't require a lot of consideration of anything, really. It's a industrial kind of McDonald's landscape.
Well, I have to say, you know, like I said, we've been letting our lawn grow sort of not by choice, but it has been, gosh, maybe it's been 3 or 4 weeks now. And instead of, you know, concentrating on the guilt about that, I was noticing yesterday that it looks really lovely. It has these really long, tufty green grasses that were sort of waving in the wind, and my son was playing on it, and it was sort of like a big fluffy carpet. And I sort of thought there's something really lovely about that, even though we're not doing anything as grand as an edible estate.
Yeah, there's a meadow. There's what Deanna Balmori calls the Freedom Lawn, which I love, which she advocates in her book. She's a landscape architect. And the Freedom Lawn is basically, it's highly diverse. It welcomes a lot of different things that come in that we typically call weeds, like clover or, you know, whatever else, dandelion, broadleaf things. It's just about these ideas of beauty. I mean, a meadow can be gorgeous, or as your previous caller was saying, in certain places, you know, a landscape where you allow certain things to come in and allow what we consider weeds to kind of flourish can be nice. I think, you know, it depends on how active a hand you want to take in your landscape. I'm just interested in these really big ideas about what does it mean to own private property in this country, and what are the responsibilities associated with that. And as each individual homeowner becomes a custodian of land, that land, what are the responsibilities involved? Today, it has to do with maintaining some sort of image and artificial kind of aesthetic. But I think in the future, it's going to be about some environmental responsibility and some sort of real sense of being a custodian of your little parcel of land. On that land, you have a decision to make about how you're going to occupy it. What you're going to do there is going to have some impact on how we all live. So I'm really interested in movements, like how can something that's not mandated from above, that's not enforced federally or by our government, but instead each individual homeowner deciding on their own what they're going to do, you know, that's going to have a huge impact on how we live. And, you know, it's not reasonable to imagine that everyone in the United States is going to remove their front lawn tomorrow and grow food. But what would happen if they did? You know, how would that change the way we live in our country? I think overnight you would see this huge shift. And it's possible. It's not specifically just growing food, but any kind of alternative to the front lawn. If all of a sudden every front lawn tomorrow was gone, it was replaced with something different that was decided upon by that homeowner, I think our whole cities would look different. Our whole way of life would be different. It's kind of astonishing when you think of it, and it wouldn't be because of any huge federal activity or huge amount of money associated with it, like a public works project. It would just be a bottom-up sort of movement, which I think would be kind of amazing.
We're talking this hour about the anti-lawn movement and things that can be done with the lawn instead of just the green mown expanse. We're talking about edible estates, which is what Fritz Haag specializes in. He's an artist, architect, and creator of the Edible Estates Project. Also talking with Ted Steinberg, who teaches in the history department of Case Western Reserve University. He's the author of American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. We'll be taking more of your phone calls right after this break, and we'd love to hear from you about how much stock you put in a green well-cut yard, and if you're thinking of doing something more off the beaten track with your yard. If you want to do an edible estate, would you consider that? Or have you let your lawn revert back to its native state? And what do the neighbors think? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Veronica Rickert here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 12:30, stay tuned for Chapter a Day as Carl Schmidt reads Crossing to Safety by Wallace Degner. This hour we're talking lawns, and the anti-lawn movement, about things that we can do with the lawns besides just grow turf grass and cut it. The Edible Estates is one idea, and we're talking with Fritz Haig, the creator of that idea. He's an artist, architect, and creator of Edible Estates Project. Also, Ted Steinberg this hour, talking with us. He teaches in the History Department of Case Western Reserve University, and he's the author of American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. And we'll take a phone call now. We've got Paul on the line calling from Madison. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I'm off the beaten path, and I haven't grown an edible landscape, but I've grown a wildflower landscape. And in Madison, we have a natural lawn ordinance, natural landscapes. And my experience has been I want to make a plug for education. And because I was actually taken to court for growing wildflowers, and the judge looked at me like I was nuts for coming there, and we did eventually resolve it, but it took about a year and a half.
Really?
And that was because people were scared, because it's tall, it's thick, they don't understand what the plants are, and just one neighbor complaining, and the city having laws that don't, that aren't educated laws, that are just, if it's over eight inches, then it's bad. And even one plant, they took a picture of one thistle plant, and we had a big to-do about that. Whereas somebody can grow, you know, a virtual farm of creeping Charlie or even garlic mustard if it's under 8 inches. So my plug is for education, and one of the things that kind of bristles me a little about anti-lawn movement, I'm worried about, you know, upping the ante, because there is some emotion behind some of this stuff. People are really emotionally tied to their lawns and emotionally scared of something different. And I think this edible estate or natural landscape movement, and to describe it as a movement and to really think about education of city officials, of neighbors, and especially of businesses like that woman talked about, because some people might need a jump start on that, might need a business who says, okay, let's do some things and we can help you do this. But right now the businesses are leaning towards a bunch of guys jumping off the truck with a bunch of herbicide and blowers and mowers, and that's what I've been seeing. So I think we really need to start a network of people, you know, to make this movement a success.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Paul. We appreciate that. And Ted Steiner, one of the interesting things that Paul brought up there was about the emotional connection people have to their lawns, and they see something that's getting kind of large and crazy looking in the front yard, and sometimes people freak out a little bit. What is it? How do you describe that, the relationship people have with their lawns? Why is it so emotionally intense? Ted Steinberg, are you there? I think we might have lost him. Well, how about you, Fritz Haig? Can you tell us why you think people are so emotionally invested in the typical green lawn?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with propriety and the kind of face that you put to your neighbors. I mean, when we talk about lawns and issues with them in neighborhood communities and regulations, it really is the front lawn we're talking about, of course. One interesting thing that comes up whenever I do these projects is people say, well, whatever you do in your backyard, that's your own business. But what you do in your front yard, that's our business, like the neighborhoods and the street.
Right.
And I think that's interesting, that idea of public and private. And I think it's emotional because it represents your relationship to your neighbors and how you feel about them. So people take a poorly tended lawn to mean you don't care about us. And it's somehow insulting to the community to show kind of disrespect on what you're doing on your front lawn. And I think it goes into even like moral character or something. I mean, it really goes deep for a lot of people. What they see symbolized by the activity that happens in someone's front yard. It's what you choose to present to your community and to your neighborhood.
Ted Steinberg, I want to get you in on this too. I don't know if you heard our last caller. I know your line cut out for a bit there. But our last caller was talking about how people have these really strong emotional connections to that green, typical front yard. And I'm wondering what your take is on why the emotion goes so deep there.
Well, I don't know exactly. Part of it is First of all, one thing that I think has been said a number of times, at least in the part of the show that I've heard, was that the lawn has no value. I don't think that's exactly true. First of all, obviously, it's got certain kind of emotional valence that people somehow cultivate here, or they're cultivating more than just a patch of lawn or a patch of grass, I should say. But more than that, I think also, I mean, there's certain things you can do on a lawn, frankly, that you can't do, with all due respect, if you're growing food in your front yard. For example, throw the ball around on the lawn. That's something I do with my kids almost every day during the the spring, summer, and fall. To just simply dismiss the lawn as having no value at all, I think is not quite accurate.
Well, we have one alternative from a caller, Eileen Roeder, maybe it's pronounced Rader, in Spring Green, Wisconsin. She emailed us a picture of one of the alternatives they did to a yard. They planted a 1.5-acre surrounding with native plants. They sent along a picture, which didn't print, unfortunately, here, but couldn't see it on the radio anyway. But they also added a green space to border the house. So maybe there's ways to incorporate both aspects here. What do you think, Fritz Haig? Are you open to maybe keeping part of the lawn so we can kick the ball around with our children and then having an edible garden somewhere else?
Oh, of course. Like, I think there's a huge problem with any movement that says there's only one way to do things. That's what gets us into trouble every time, and every political system that has that as its foundation, or any movement that has that as its core belief, is inherently flawed, I think. So I'm advocating diversity, and I'm advocating, like, people making conscious decisions about what they're doing. And I think, like I said before, there's always a place for a nice lawn for recreational activity, but I do think if you look at most neighborhoods in the United States, the front lawn is underused, and it's in most cases symbolic. So you do see neighborhoods where people feel comfortable playing ball in the front lawn, and that's great. I mean, if the front lawns in a street are used and people are actively occupying them, and then by in that regard, like, also connecting with their neighbors in their streets, I think that's obviously fantastic. And But I think that's less common, particularly in newer housing developments. We see these lawns maniacally tended and then really vacant. I mean, most front lawns are only really occupied when they're being mowed or watered. And aside from that, they don't tend to get used that much.
Let's take another phone call. We've got Carol with us from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, sir, earlier Elizabeth mentioned the national group called Wild Ones that promotes landscaping with native plants and sustainable landscaping, and I serve, I'm serving a term as the national president of that, so I'm very much enjoying your show. There's a couple specific things I wanted to add to the discussion. One is on the subject of getting away from the typical green lawn, and that some people are uncomfortable with that. We had a presenter at a conference a couple years ago, Professor Joan Nassauer, is a landscape architecture professor at the School of Natural Resources at University of Michigan now, and they've done these research where they show people pictures of houses. They get to choose a house style, and then they show them a typical lawn landscape, a lawn with 25% natives and 75% lawn, and then 50-50, 75, and they take it all the way to 100%. And what they found was the biggest driver in people's preferences, as I recall, was mainly what their neighbors had. So it kind of gets back to, I think, what Fritz said earlier about branding and marketing. There's so much out there, big bucks promoting lawns. But if we can get communities that know the ecological benefits of getting away from the lawn, especially the unused part of your lawn, and replacing that with either edibles or native plants, I think this movement really is going to move forward. And I think it's going to have to, as the cost of fuel goes up, as the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions goes up. I really think this is going to move forward.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Carol. Interesting perspective there, especially about choosing based on what the neighbors have. What do you think, Fritz Haig?
Yeah, it's interesting. In the Edible Estates book, we have a lot of essays and stories, and each one of the garden homeowners, that Edible Estate owners that I worked with and the four gardens represented have blogs or essays or kind of stories of their experiences. So it's really kind of like a storybook in that regard. And one of them, the first garden in Salina, Kansas, the owner said that every single person, almost everyone who came up and talked to him about his garden, their first concern was that their neighbors wouldn't like it. Their assumption was the neighbors didn't like it. They liked it, but they assumed nobody else would. And I think people are open to it, but it does come out of, you know, people don't want to stick out. You don't want to be the freak on the street doing something doing something different. There's a certain sense, certain amount of conformity that we want in our front lawns and in our landscaping. We want to feel like we're part of a larger fabric of a community, which I think is, you know, it's a good thing. And I think a lot of the beginnings of the lawn movement were about that, a democratic society where we were all communally tending this one landscape of continuous lawn from yard to yard, unbroken by a fence. So what happens when one person on the street deviates? Hopefully they do a good job and it becomes a model for other possibilities, and other people on the street feel are given some license to do something similar. But I think that's an amazing point about what people feel is appropriate, because it's not just about what they think is appropriate individually in one front lawn, but it's what makes sense contextually in terms of what everybody else around them is doing. So, you know, there's some streets and neighborhoods where this is very common, where there aren't any lawns left and everyone's growing natives or planting food. And in that case, someone coming in and planting a lawn would be the freak, you know, and they would be the person who's deviating from the norm. You know, so a lot of it has to do with these like larger social issues.
Let's get one more call in. Here's Kate calling from Madison. Hi, Kate.
Hi. I recently moved to Madison from a suburb of Philadelphia and found out suddenly that I was very allergic to dandelions. And just in the community that I was in, everybody sprayed their lawn for dandelions or dug them up or whatever. And coming to Madison, almost every single front lawn for the entire beginning of the summer was covered in dandelions. So I didn't even know that they were that prolific. You know, I had occasionally been to some parks and seen them and played with them as a kid, but was just very surprised. So I actually feel like the Madison area is very much for the kind of loose interpretation of lawn compared to what I grew up.
I tend to notice a kind of east-west side divide on that. In our neighborhood, everyone's got the neat lawn, but on the east side, it tends to be a little bit more artsy. Have you noticed that, Kate?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that call, Kate. And Ted Steinberg, do you think that there are sort of different areas where people respond to lawns differently? Have you noticed that?
Well, I've not done any kind of study of that sort of thing, but I do think there are different lawn cultures depending on neighborhoods, and you know, I think there's a relationship between how much the lawn is used and the kind of grass species that you have planted on your front lawn. I mean, for example, in my neighborhood, I mean, the lawns that aren't being used typically are the lawns of the very wealthy people who have creeping bent grass planted in their front yards, which is the same kind of grass that you would find on a putting green, essentially. Hmm. They're not going to be out there throwing the ball around on their lawn. On the other hand, where I'm living, on my block at least, I mean, it's not at all uncommon to see people throwing the ball around and enjoying the front yard quite a good deal. And the grass species, of course, are, you know, well, a mix of plantain, clover, moss, rye, bluegrass, everything's in there.
And Fritz Haig, would you consider, I don't know what your lawn looks like now, but do you have a little patch of green there along with everything else?
Well, I the house I've been in for 8 years is on a hillside, so I get out of that kind of scrutiny of what my front lawn looks like, because my house is right on the street. I don't have a front lawn, and I don't have any lawn. It's just mostly fruit trees and edibles and things like that. But
well, we've got about a minute to go. Can you just give me some tips for people who live in Wisconsin where it might not be so obvious what you can plant that's going to flourish if you want to follow this idea?
Well, you know, again, it's so completely regional. I think even a very expert gardener from one side of the country, if you put them in the other, in a completely different part of the country, you know, there's certain gardening skills you can bring with you, but it's not like, you know, there's information that previously was handed down generation to generation about basic information about how you grow food where you are. And we've lost that, and now we're dependent on books to tell us, which is great. You know, there's plenty of books available. But you don't really know about growing things until you've done it yourself in that place for a few seasons. And I don't really know about any plants until I've done them for a few seasons. So I never feel comfortable giving specific advice about growing any particular place where I haven't gardened before. In all of the gardens that I do all over the country, I work with families. I select families who are avid gardeners in that region who know more about gardening there than I do.
Okay, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Yeah. This has been great to talk to you. Lots of ideas, and I appreciate your time. And also, Ted Steinberg, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We've been talking about the anti-lawn movement with Fritz Haig and Ted Steinberg, and I want to thank Keisha Mabra for on-air production this hour, and good luck to her as she goes off to pursue new and big things. Also, Rhonda Fanning, thank you for the production this hour.